I want to start by sharing some thoughts from a counsellor that I trained under. He made these comments. He said, some of us are wildly bipolar, but don't know it. He didn't mean mood swings, but he meant swinging from being obsessed about work to going hard after pleasure, working anxiously and then going back to, you deserve a break today, that kind of mindset. And he's saying lots of people cycle through this every day, even multiple times a day. I wonder if you can relate to that experience. One moment obsessing about your work, then escaping from it and things that trouble you by going hard after pleasure or comfort. These thoughts come from David Powlison, and some of you might sound a bit familiar, for those of you who read an article by him a couple of years back. But later in that article, he adds that he's kind of critiquing our culture, and he's suggesting that people that we look up to in our world, our heroes, and also the types of things that we want to achieve in life, that they tend to relate to the fields of entertainment and these areas that we turn to for distraction or relief. So we follow comedians, people who make careers from their downtime activities. I think of, professional video games. And we follow sports heroes, adventurers. We look at the fashion industry, the sex industry. We go after technology and anything that feels good. He says we choose from an array of distractions, things that pull at our hearts, things to watch. He wrote this before streaming services existed. Things to buy, things to do. He says desire is the most high God. Limits are the only sin. Every possible kind of enjoyment becomes like a niche market. And I wonder if at the root what's going on here is that our culture maybe just doesn't give us enough depth. If it can't give us answers to life's deepest troubles. If it can't give us a way to understand and guide us through life in this broken world. And so what it leaves us with is escape. Life is hard. Do what you can to find a bit of pleasure. Drown out the pain. Get away from it. Life is just about distracting yourself from the hard things so you can find whatever enjoyment you can. I wonder, does that message resonate with you? Do you hear it in the culture around us? Do you feel its pull at your own heart? Well, today's passage speaks to these very things. And I think it gives us a better path than escape. It's about God-orienting wisdom for life in this world, a world where we face trouble and uncertainty, a world where all sorts of competing messages pull at our hearts. You know what's come in Ecclesiastes? It's been a year since we looked at a portion of it, this time kind of last year. The chapter before, at the end of that chapter, 6 verse 12, is a question. Who knows what is good for a man in life? And I think the teacher in Ecclesiastes is actually convinced that some ways are better than others. So chapter 7 kind of flows on from that question, and it starts with the value of wisdom, how wisdom actually helps us in verses 1 to 12. And next week, we'll look at the second half of the chapter, which I think in some senses focuses on wisdom's limitations. But our passage today, the first half, it kind of comes to us as a series of proverbs. I think it'd be helpful for us to remember a couple of things as we go through them. Firstly, the teacher does want us to have joy. He's been talking about this in the ordinary stuff of life. So he's not a Scrooge who's kind of against fun and good times. And the second thing is he's been looking at all the different types of evil that happens under the sun. And in light of that, he's calling us to live a serious and focused life, because such is the nature of the world we live in. So our first point is this. Wisdom says, look death in the eye and learn, from verses 1 to 6. Wisdom says, look death in the eye and learn. Listen for the seriousness in verse 1. A good name is better than fine perfume. and the day of death better than the day of birth. Two comparisons. A good name is better than perfume. The day of death is better than the day of birth. What really matters? That you wear a fragrance, perhaps, that David Beckham puts his name to? Or for the ladies, Dior or something else? Is it important that you own something so precious? Or that you enjoy the status that it brings? Or is what really matters that you're known to be someone of integrity, character, a person of their word? The teacher's highlighting for us that it's character that matters. And I think this is why he says the day of death is better than the day of birth. See, what do we think of when we think of the day of birth? A new arrival enters this world. And there's joy, opportunities for life ahead. We think of the excitement that we shared, the arrival of Evelyn, Lucy among us. Something profoundly wonderful about that, right? The thing that's different about the day of death is it reveals the kind of person someone was. You know, I think of my grandparents who both died, and they knew Jesus well, and I've been significantly shaped by them. I also saw their flaws up close in some ways, but kind of overarching, when their deaths drew near and we gathered for their funerals and we had opportunity to speak and talk together of their lives, there were some just wonderful things that stood out to me from the wisdom and care that they'd show, the type of people they were. But suppose someone close to you mistreated you, and that's what comes back at the day of their death. Whether the person was good or bad, the day of death has a lot to say about the kind of person they were. Now, in our world, sometimes the faithful person, the person of character, can be overlooked. Favoured instead is someone who's impressive or someone who has the gift of the gab. They can get the promotion, they can get picked, they can get chosen. And this can make us feel like God's not with us. But the teacher's reminding us to stay the course. A good name in the end really is better, since the day of death is better than the day of birth. Moves us on to verse 2, and I think this is right at the heart of our passage, of what our passage is getting at. Listen to the comparison that it makes. First half of verse 2, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Better is a house of mourning to go to than a house of feasting. Better to go to a funeral than to a party. Why? Second half, verse 7, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. No one escapes death. It comes to all of us. When we're confronted with death, it gives us this opportunity to bring things into sharp focus. The book of Hebrews speaks of how we were all in slavery to our fear of death, but how Jesus frees us from that. So we don't have to live in denial. We can actually look death in the eye. But around us, as I spoke earlier, escape, we have messages in our culture that kind of prompts us not to bother examining life, to look closely at it, to be preoccupied with constant distractions or seeking after momentary pleasures. What the teacher is saying here, though, is that we need to take it to heart. I think there are kind of two ways we can go wrong in terms of not taking this to heart. One of them is kind of being fairly bleak in our outlook of life, even depressed about the trouble in the world, but not letting that lead you to the point of reflecting deeply about what really matters and how each of us should live. So it's possible still to feel lots of negative emotion, but not let it have it do its work on you. The other is that kind of turning to pleasures to distract us, so we never ask the important questions about whether our life reflects our values and whether it reflects what's most important. We'll come back to the how to take it to heart shortly. In verses 3 to 5, I think we see that we're being called to have this kind of serious response, and it involves what we might call having negative emotions versus the contrast, which is escaping. So verse 3, frustration is better than laughter because a sad face is good for the heart. The word behind frustration there is often translated as a form of anger. And I think it's getting at being displeased about the things that God is displeased about. A good anger, a redemptive anger. Now, this might sound countercultural. You know, if things go wrong in this world, maybe we just laugh about it, we play it down, we ignore it, we push it down, minimize it. But I think what the teacher is giving us here is an invitation to a type of gladness that we might not have tasted before. That is, I think God wants us to feel a whole gamut of emotions. And sometimes that's completely appropriate for us to feel anger in a good way. I think of my own experience in Bible college. Early on, I had a season of depression. And I think one of the things that was beneath that was some hard experiences that I'd had in my upbringing that I just wanted to push down and ignore, pain that I didn't want to face. The problem with doing that, though, was that kind of it left me with this kind of emotional flatlining, this sense of being numb. To push things down is to also bring down the highs. I didn't have that full gamut. I think this is where God is leading us, living in this world. In verse 5, we read, "It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools." Now, it might be hard to hear honest feedback when our character has come up short, but it's far better for us to listen to that, to take it on board, than to drown it out with the song of fools. Now, these kind of contrasts that the teacher is drawing, he's not telling us that these things are bad: birth, feasting, laughter, pleasure, songs. They're good things. The problem is they become unhelpful if we use them as escape. He's saying, don't live with these things at your center. Don't use these things as noise to drown out what's hard and painful. Don't let these things stop you from thinking, reflecting, taking to heart all that God wants you to learn. And then in verse 6, he gives us kind of a summary image of what he said so far. "Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless." What's the image? Found this confusing at first, but I think he's talking actually about a pot plant. There's a strong, sturdy-looking pot that something's growing out of. It's flourishing. It looks impressive. But look beneath that pot, and what you see is thorns growing out. The pot is cracking. Very soon it will not hold water. It's just going to run out the bottom. And the blooms on that plant that look so healthy are going to wither away. That's his picture for the person who kind of doesn't face the hard things in life. They might look good for a while, but very soon it's all going to come crumbling down. It's all going to wither away. What's he doing with us in this section? Well, like the analogy Zach Eswine uses, he talks about it being like a halftime talk by a coach. I don't know what your sport is, whether it's NRL, AFL, netball, cricket. But if your team's down, really struggling, there are a couple of different directions a coach could handle that, right? The first is like, there's no point in focusing. Let's just give up. Let's have a few drinks. Let's have a party after the game. Let's forget about this trouble. Who cares? Let's laugh the night away until it hurts. The second is this: focus. This is no time for laughing. I want a team who's switched on, willing to do the hard yards. If that's not you, there's the door. Anyone feeling that ache of defeat and intimidation creeping up on you? Well, don't ignore it. Look it in the eye. Don't let it own you. It's time to be serious. There's another half to be played, and it's time to lay your heart and soul on the line. Give it your all. That's what the teacher is saying to us. Wisdom says, look death in the eye and learn. How do we do this? I wonder if we engage differently in the way that we're confronted with death in some way when it happens. One of the first times I was confronted with death was sometime after I finished high school. One of the younger kids who had caught the school bus with me occasionally, who'd come occasionally to our youth group. He didn't come from a Christian family. He was a friend of my sister's. He was killed in a car accident about the age of 21. And the pastor I knew at the time took the funeral. But that was just a confronting reality for all of us, as we had so much hope for what our lives would bring ahead. And yet here is this guy that we knew. It's suddenly, it's all over. It's come to an end. Got me thinking of, you know, I don't really know what he did with the content of the message about Jesus that he heard. It got us to start to think about what really mattered. But you probably know any number of stories like this. I think of Danny sharing a few years ago about his friend in ministry that he went through college with, leaving behind a wife and multiple kids and being a really capable guy. Some of you knew that MAF pilot Chris Coffey killed in a car accident early last year. All sorts of things like this come up for us, don't they? Well, next time you attend a funeral, let death teach you. Allow yourself to feel the sadness and loss of that person. Reflect on their life. Where did their life align with God's purposes? What can you learn from what they did well? In what ways did their life bless and benefit those around them? And where did they miss God's purposes? Perhaps what's tragic about the way they lived? In what ways did they harm or hinder the good of those around them? We need to hear the things that death is preaching. Life is precious. Life is brief. No one knows how long they have. Have you considered your own death? That's one of the things that's certain about your life, that you will die. Jesus really does free us from a fear of death, though, so we don't have to deny it. We don't have to push it down like so many in our culture. We can allow death to strengthen our resolve and our focus, help us to live seriously, to live for what matters. Allow death to shape us so that we pray like the psalmist in Psalm 39. Show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting life is. And a bit later, but now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. Life is a deeply serious matter. And death and God's judgment and his rescue, these are central matters to life. Now, life is serious, but it's not gloomy. After all, in Revelation, we hear we've been invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb, this great feast celebrating Jesus and his goodness. We kind of see this seriousness but enjoyment coming together in the person of Jesus, right? He was focused on God, but he had this freedom and joy, even in the midst of trouble and grief. He didn't have to escape the things that were hard about life. The man of sorrows enjoyed God's good creation. And he models for us serious life and real enjoyment. But we're seeing wisdom says, look death in the eye and learn. That brings us to point two. Wisdom says, take the longer view, verses 7 to 10. Wisdom says, take the longer view. It starts in verse 7. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. What's going on here? Well, someone might start a wise person, but suppose others demand money from them by force, extortion, or they're kind of pressured to be part of that kind of behaviour, or being dishonest in their business practices by colleagues, and they give in. Or an honest policeman is given a wad of cash to make him turn a blind eye to a traffic offence, for example. What happens in these situations? Well, the wisdom, that integrity, that character that person had, it gets lost. And a wise person becomes a fool. The heart is corrupted. Decisions in the moment, the short term, they change the long-term outcome. And we're brought back to the end of a matter in verse 8. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Just like the day of death is better than the day of birth, the end of something is better than its beginning. It's at the end that we truly see the measure of a person, or whether they were wise or foolish. But we also see the outcome of particular moments of character. And in this verse, what's being highlighted is patience. We're better slowing ourselves down, taking time to respond instead of reacting rashly in pride. I want things my way or in my time. And this naturally flows into verse 9. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. So wisdom beckons us to take the longer view. When we're riled up about something, we're best slowing down, processing what's happened, rather than lashing out in the heat of a moment. And the image is of anger being nursed in our laps like a baby. And I think it's capturing that anger has this addictive kind of nature to it. It wants to be kept warm. It wants to be held always with us, just beneath the surface, ready to pop out at any moment. Putting this together with verse 3, that translation of frustration, we're to be angry with what God is angry about. It's not that all anger is wrong. For example, it's a good thing to bring a fool to his senses, to help someone to see their waywardness, to express a good displeasure over something they did, and to do that for their best interests. But that's different, that kind of good anger. It's different to being impatient or to being proud. To be impatient or proud in their anger, that's to be a fool. Moving on to verse 10, he says, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it's not wise to ask such questions. And again, I wonder if it's the longer view, the outcome is kind of looking forward that's in view here. And there are a couple of ways I can think of that we can look back on the past as the good old days. One is perhaps for us, those of us who are older, to kind of maybe put down the younger generation as if we're somehow better in our day. Back in my day, we would never have spoken to our parents like that. But Ecclesiastes, it brings us this kind of humbling picture of life where there's nothing new back in chapter 1, where it's kind of the same thing cycling round and around. And I think sin and its expressions, that there's a sense in which they're the same as they always have been. And so I think we're to have a humility that we're actually really no different to those who were before us, whether in heart orientation, in the type of seasons we face, types of trouble. There's actually a commonality to all of us, right? And there's a folly that suggests that somehow one generation was fundamentally different to the next. I like how Zach Eswine puts it. He says, hard-heartedness, it's like a relay baton passed on from each generation to the next. Well, we all have that problem, right? But there's this other way we can look back as well, where it can kind of be a bit fruitless, another way of escaping the present. I remember the good old days before the internet, before smartphones. If only we could go back to then. But if we kind of get lost in that, it can stop us from acting now, avoiding the reality of what is. This way of thinking, it can impose burdens on people today. So think of a young person who can't actually go back to the past, has got no way of accessing that. So if we kind of take the longer view, if we set the present in light of the future, we allow people to change. A new path ahead can be forged. If we take the example of smartphones, yes, they are impacting us in all sorts of ways, and some of them are concerning when it comes to our attention span, to our being always on, the pull of instant gratification. But I don't think going back to the day before they existed is going to help our teens today. Instead, we need to help them have a vision for a different way of living with a smartphone, to model it well ourselves, to help them see different ways that self-control can benefit all of us, and how this kind of self-control is essential to the good that Jesus wants to form in all of us. To get stuck on the good old days is not wise. We've seen wisdom says, take the longer view. That brings us to our last point. Wisdom says, I'll give you life, verses 11 to 12. Wisdom says, I'll give you life. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. What happens if your parents pass on and they leave you an inheritance? Well, it gives you a surplus of funds. It may relieve financial pressure, allow you to repay some debts, or open up options that just weren't there before. It's a good thing. The teacher continues the first half of verse 12. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. The money, like getting an inheritance when your parents die, it's something of a shelter for us. It can protect us from some of the harshness of life. Ease the pressure, add a little comfort. And wisdom is like this. Provides shelter for us in the brokenness of this world. But it's more. It's actually better than money, the second half of verse 12. The advantage of knowledge is this. Wisdom preserves those who have it. Wisdom keeps you alive. It gives you life. It has this guarding, protecting, preserving sense. So in Proverbs 2, 11 to 12, we read, discretion will protect you and understanding will guard you. Wisdom will save you from the ways of wicked men, from men whose words are perverse. There's a sense in which it keeps us from destructive paths, and in this way it gives us life. But it's also life-giving in a sense of helping us to live well, to flourish, to live as we were designed. Let me read a portion of Proverbs 3. Blessed are those who find wisdom, those who gain understanding, for she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand, and in her left are riches and honour. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. Those who hold her fast will be blessed. We also know it's not always the case that we'll live longer. Sometimes the good do die young. The whole of the Bible helps us see the bigger picture. Those of us who live by God's wisdom. Some of us may have a short life now. But when we belong to the Lord, our life is kind of continues beyond the grave, beyond death. And that shortness is made up for what we have in eternity. Well, we've seen that wisdom says, I'll give you life. So to recap the 3 points from this morning, we've seen wisdom say 3 things. Firstly, look death in the eye and learn. Take the longer view, second point. Third point, I'll give you life. Before I lead us in prayer, I just want to share some closing thoughts to help us take things to heart. So I alluded to in an introduction and throughout, we live in this kind of escapist culture. Our world is willing to party its way to death. And there are things that are no doubt profoundly difficult about the human experience. It can be hard living in a world that tells us our worth is based on how useful we are at making money, by our output, how productive we are. All sorts of restraints that our world can place on us in terms of our imagination, our creativity. And try as it might, it can't really tell us what life means, what it's all about. But we're not escapists. The Bible helps us to see life as it really is, confronting reality rather than escaping from it. Death was once our great enemy, but Jesus has defeated it. Now instead, death is our friend. Let me paraphrase a quote from Ann Proven. God wants death and its friend illness to break in on us and confront us with reality. We are mortal beings who only live for a short time. But God is God. Death is an evangelist. And when he says death is an evangelist, he goes on to say that it gets our attention. It points out that there's this great gap between us and God. And death puts us in a position to turn to God, to see him as he is, in all his greatness, to own up to the fact that we've not treated him as God. But he's also profoundly good. He offers us full forgiveness in Jesus. And then death and illness become further kindnesses to help us to see how precious and fragile here and now life really is. They offer us the beginnings of wisdom and an insight about how to live well during our time here. We kind of have that courage to look death in the eye we're given this opportunity to embrace wisdom, to take on serious living before God, which has at its heart the fear of the Lord. Let's close by praying together from Psalm 90, part of Psalm 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, "Return to dust, you mortals." 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. Yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. Teach us to number our days, that we might gain a heart of wisdom.